So let's reach out to our Sangha members. Welcome everybody today. Hello everyone. Notice this can bring some smiles and a little bit more sense of interaction, which is sometimes missing in our Zoom chats, but wishing individual people doing Secret Santa, particular square, and then columns and rows, and the whole group. May everybody here be well. May everybody here be peaceful. May everybody have a day of ease, no matter what the conditions. So, nice to see you all. Yeah, get a little floating heart. So, welcome back for those of you who were here yesterday, and welcome if you're joining us for today. Today we're going to be continuing on with in the map of the 16 steps of Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. And the point of this weekend is fairly focused on just what these steps are and how the Buddha taught mindfulness of breathing as a progressive teaching. And in this, we're really looking at the technique. We're really looking at the technique of guiding our mind and our attention towards insights the Buddha wanted us to have that were not common for just living your everyday life. So because of that teaching and this technique, it's not necessarily a very broad view of Buddhism. It's not a very integrated view, including how to relate to the whole of your life. So just want to say that there's a lot going on for all of us in our daily lives. And these particular techniques are to help our nervous system come back and be gathered from its typical overwhelmed and fragmented state. That more collected heart, mind, and space from these techniques can then engage the world more productively, and the heart doesn't feel as exhausted and as fragmented. So it plays, these techniques play a role in a larger picture, but to teach about how these 16 steps work and how they work together, we're focusing very much on how to use mindfulness of breathing to, again, calm the mind down, calm the body down, open up an inherent sense of well-being from within, which uncouples us from our dependence upon the outside world and trying to control it for our happiness. And then from that development of heart and mind, when we get up and we walk around and we interact, one, we can stay more connected to our breath and our body, which is helpful when we do interact with the world. But just because we're spending this much time on this part of the Buddha's teachings doesn't mean you're supposed to spend the rest of your life doing this, only this. And it's not a full enough sense of caring for the world, working in the world, the diversity of our relationships on many levels. But this can play a role in how we start sorting out a much bigger picture of our life, knowing how to be more collected, more embodied, how to regroup after a time of being overstimulated and fragmented. So in that way, it does play a very key role in that larger Dharma picture, but we're spending the whole weekend focusing on these 16 steps and how they work and how we can cultivate that, with some implicit understanding that it plays a role in the larger context of the Buddha's teachings. So the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths as a big picture, and he taught the Eightfold Path as the ways we're supposed to develop along that path. And here we're really just working on the meditative piece, but we're not talking about the broadest view of suffering in the world. We're not talking about the ethical dimensions of being on the path. And it's not that those aren't important. It's just we also need to talk about the meditative techniques and spend this much time Even a weekend will feel very quick, like we're galloping through important topics, but it's rare to get access to look at this. So hopefully what I'm offering here is putting some context around this much time spent on these techniques that are very helpful for calming your nervous system when it's overwhelmed, gathering your attention from what's typically more scattered. And then from that, how to develop mindfulness in a way that helps with the larger path and the larger goals of Buddhist practice. So in our time of questions and responses, and today we can talk on that larger level, if there are questions on that larger level, like how to integrate this and care for the world that needs a lot of care. Another thing to say is that what we described yesterday could take, if you took several years to just master what we talked about yesterday in terms of knowing your breath, better knowing your body, knowing how to find happiness in how you're relating to your breath and body, and learning to calm down very aggravating habits that keep us overwhelmed, that you're not supposed to have mastered that yesterday, and therefore you should be able to keep up with the pace at which the weekend is going through this material. And if you were so moved by the practices of yesterday, that might be a sign that that's where your practice feels ripe, that's what you're interested in practicing. And there are many people I know that say, now that I've been exposed to a lot of the Buddha's teachings, I really want this simpleness, this wholeness of attention, and that's what I'm inspired to do. So you wouldn't have to feel like you have to move on from the practices described yesterday. The practices described yesterday are samatha meditation techniques, and their goal is deeper samadhi, this wholeness of attention and inner sense of well-being, and putting a lot of our afflicted states into quietude or into dormancy. And that's their goal. There's a lot that we learn along the way that's helpful. But today we're going to get into going beyond those first 12 steps to look at what is the beginning of the Vipassana practice. And you'll see it has a different emphasis, a different tenor. So we'll get into that. Another thing to say is that just like if we had a record player and we were playing a progressive sense of European classical music, doesn't mean today we should start exactly where we left off yesterday. That you might also need to kind of start where you can and build upon that. So one problem with this technique and its linear presentation is that you get dharma craving, dharma clinging, and dharma selfing. I really liked the 2 o'clock hour yesterday, everything was just perfect. So I want to always start there. And if I'm not there, then I'm frustrated. That's dharma craving and clinging, and maybe some dharma selfing. Like, I want to be that person. I don't actually want to practice where I am right now. I want to somehow accumulate and hold on to things that happened yesterday. And just as a record needle wouldn't cling to the music played yesterday, which is why it's so loyal and so beautiful, is whatever is played today, the record needle rests in the groove of all the music that it plays, and then for its whole life it can play a wide variety of music. So even though we're going to add on a couple of more steps in these 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, you have to always be willing to begin again, humbly begin again, and see if you can connect with your breathing or your body. Or, as we said, you can substitute sounds or simple visual sights and work with that before you try adding on more and more nuances of meditation. And it's probably the number one block to progressive practice is people get attached to and then resistance to humbly start over again. And then you spend a lot of time frustrated with what's happening and trying to force something to happen rather than patiently cultivating the steps that allow things to happen. So everybody, just shake off yesterday. Carry the inspiration, carry the warmth, maybe some coals from yesterday to restart the fire. But today is today, and we are in the conditions of today, both internally and externally. It's where we want our practice to always meet ourselves. May we love ourselves just as we are. And that includes how we are right now. And each part of the day as it unfolds. So I'll guide you through the practices, but just to start the conversation, what happens in the last four steps of the 16 is that you go up through steps 12 and you're very content with just breathing. The mind has become simple. And in that contentment and simplicity, there can be a stability of presence. And the heart mind starts to feel very fluid and very smooth within that fluidity. And there are a lot of beautiful qualities that can arise in that fluidity. And a lot of our turbulent qualities of anger and impatience and craving what we don't have can go into quietude because the samadhi itself is so rewarding that the mind doesn't want its turbulent factors. And you can keep strengthening that. The switch over into Vipassana goes from that mode to where, right in the intimacy of what's happening, you recognize that even though it's smooth and there might be a kind of homogeneity in the smoothness, a new breath in, a new breath out, very calm, very collected. In that moment, everything you're experiencing is also fresh. You're not feeling the breath of yesterday. You're feeling, you're hearing, everything you're experiencing is fresh. And mysteriously, something fresh arises, like sounds or new thoughts. And so you start using the basis of samadhi to become intimate with how fresh and mysterious everything that arises is. You don't know if a sound will arise, and yet when it arises, you hear it very clearly. So it's fresh, it's mysterious, and nothing arises to stay. So a sound happens, and then the sound fades, and no little bit of the sound keeps echoing. Dog barks, dog stops barking, things go quiet again. A thought happens, a thought releases, things go quiet again. So you use the intimacy of the samadhi right in the flow of your experience to start appreciating mindfully the arising and passing nature of all your experience. That's happening all along, but it wasn't a primary feature to tune into. You're tuning into the satisfaction of breathing, just one part of the breath, being content in just breathing. That's very good for samadhi. It's very simple. It tends towards ease. It tends towards simplicity. Once you start getting to the arising and passing, it's not simple because there's a lot of distinct things happening. So when you think about a stream of water, one way you could look at it is that there's a lot of flow, and you know, you turn a garden hose on, You could look at it as a steady stream, and that's accurate, but you can also see it's fresh water leaving the hose all the time. And so there is this arising, passing nature while there's also a steady stream, and that's not in contradiction. So it's of a different flavor to go from simplicity, relaxation, ease of the samatha techniques that lead towards samadhi, to start introducing the vipassana techniques, which are to notice arising and passing, to notice impermanence. You don't have to start looking around to see impermanence like a chicken pecking at food, constantly turning your attention. Right in the relaxed, steady stream of samadhi, there is a lot of change. Like if you feel your body, the samadhi practice was like, oh, there's a body, I love it. Here's my torso, here are my legs, a live body. It's a great refuge. It's so simple. That leads to samadhi. In that same intimacy with the body, you can say, wow, a new heartbeat, and it's gone. A new tingling, and that's gone. I was cold a few minutes ago, now I'm warm. Wow, the same body that I was finding so simple is now constantly fluctuating. If you could approach in the right way, seeing all that arising and passing doesn't undermine the samadhi of being in the body. But it can be that when you start to see all the differences that are happening, the mind begins to fragment a little bit on all the differences. And before you know it, your mind's wandering and you don't feel this underlying samadhi. There you are welcome to start pendulating, where you come back to just simple breathing, being in the body, collecting yourself and practicing samatha techniques for samadhi. And then when you feel collected and calm, you can go back to appreciating nuances and changeability, and that nothing's ever the same. So that's the way you can use these two practices, going back to forth, back and forth. So you don't have to hold that map in the front of your mind. I was just pre-exposing you to what we're going to explore today. With that said, let's find a posture of stillness motivated by kindness to your animal body, this loyal companion of your body. What still posture would your body enjoy so it could have a relaxed sense of ease? And then some wisdom might come in and say, actually, if I slouch over, it feels good for about 3 minutes, but then it doesn't feel good. So I want to give my body ease, but with wisdom, I want to find a posture that I think will give me stillness over time, but still it's a kind choice to my body. My body is not to be sacrificed for whatever we're doing here. My body can be cared for. For some people, that does mean lying down. And for some people, it means sitting in a way that's supportive, learning about your body and how to support it. And you can roll your shoulders a little bit just to make sure that you're not starting the practice with unconscious bracing in your neck and shoulders. Roll your jaw, roll your neck, just gently. And we have all these unconscious holding patterns in our body that we're inviting to relax. Allow yourself to take a few deep breaths. You might welcome the in-breath as a sense of fresh arising in breath. Feel that awakening, the nourishment of breathing. You can also focus on the out-breath, the natural release, the relaxation. Nothing has to be held on to. The more deep the exhale, the more room there is for a fresh inhale. And you can trust the wisdom of your body knows how to breathe. And you can relax, let your breath become natural. Out of kindness to your heart and mind, you can release and exhale everything connected with the past. The past can become books on a shelf. You can pull them out at any point, read about your past, look at pictures. But you don't have to keep carrying the past like a backpack full of weight that you have to sort out. You can relax your relationship to the past. And you're allowed to relax your entire relationship to the future. At the end of this day, you can pick up your future and contemplate it. But in formal practice, the future won't be so helpful. And we're turning with a lot of faith and trust towards the flow of simple present time experiences. We can consciously and unconsciously let go of the future, the past. We can also let go of any complicated relationship to the present, any way that we're approaching the present with too many concepts and too many tools and too many pressures and priorities. The basis of our practice can be this gift of simplicity, this gift of rest. Further calming down what is agitated, patiently collecting what is scattered. Allowing a wholeness of heart and mind from what is often fragmented. And for most of us, breathing in and being aware you're breathing in, and being aware when you're breathing out, can become the fundamental practice of mindfulness. With some time, this becomes easier, but all of us have to make some transition to let go of complexity. Let go of the project mind, the accomplishing mind, And now we're floating like a stick slightly offshore, going up and down with the waves. We take in an in-breath. We release on an out-breath. And see if you can rest simply and draw some contentment from having such a simple thing to do. In and out breathing, inside the live body, a live human animal body. It does the breathing, and we just appreciate it. You might see if adding a metta phrase every now and then supports this resting contentedly, just as you are. May I love myself just as I am. May I be kind to myself just as I am. If you combine the sentiment of that metta phrase with your breathing, with the sense of your body in this posture, you might find that there's a certain amount of contentment and ease and simplicity. Please notice the attitude you have when your mind wanders and you bring it back. If there's any tone of frustration or force, you may be trying too hard to stay with your breath. We want a kind and patient attitude. build a positive relationship to recognizing that we are wandering, a positive relationship to coming back to the breath, not a scolding or perfectionistic attitude. At some point, we can wake up our relationship to our bodies. So using our in and out breathing to be inside the body. Again, you could support yourself with a loving kindness phrase, such as, may I love my body just as it is. May I be kind to my body. Just as it is. You may say that every now and then to see if that aligns your approach to mindfulness practice. And starting with our shoulders. You can feel them rise and fall with breathing. You might also appreciate their bones and muscles and skin. Find a balance between not so relaxed that you wander easily, but not so much effort that you're struggling or forcing. Appreciating your shoulders, especially the sensations of your alive shoulders. You can include your shoulder blades and your upper back. Feel what you feel as you breathe. Including the back of your rib cage. Your muscles and your skin. Appreciate your mid back, your lower back. from the bottom of your rib cage, through your muscles, your spinal column, down into your hips and your pelvis and your sacrum. Breathing in and out, you can appreciate your legs, the bone, the muscle, the skin. And then there's your knees, your lower legs. Bones, soft tissues and skin, your lower legs. May I love my body just as it is. We can feel our ankles and our heels, the soles of our feet, the front pads of our feet, and our toes. Supported by our in and out breathing, we can become aware of our shoulders again, and our upper arms, our elbows, lower arms, wrists, hands, palms of our hands and fingers. We can come up from our hands to the front of our torso, feeling our bellies, soft tissue of our organs, our muscles and our skin. Further up to our solar plexus, our diaphragm, and our rib cage, and our chest. Here, the soft tissue is central. The bones are around the soft tissue. Then muscle and then skin of our upper torso and our chest. Coming up to our throat. Our tongue and our jaw and our teeth. And our lips and our nose, our eyes and our cheeks. Soft tissue and skin, behind it bone, and opening to the sides of our head with our ears, plus our forehead, top of the head and back of the head, our skull, our skin, the hair on the top of our head. See if you can relax with some contentedness. Be happy and content while you breathe in and out inside of this body. And for moments, maybe that's all you need in those moments. It's relaxed gratitude for your body and appreciation of its aliveness. And rhythm of breathing. This is a taste of samadhi. Inner well-being, relaxation, and collectedness of attention. And then right here, you can add in an appreciation of the fresh nature in the flow of your experience. It's not the same old breath, but it's this breath, freshly arising, freshly passing. It's these bird calls, or dogs barking, or cars driving by, as sounds, freshly known. So right in the stream of the samadhi, you might see that it helps your awareness stay bright. With fresh body sensations. Fresh breathing. Fresh sounds. And yet still there is a peaceful flow. We can welcome an attitude that receives each breath as a fresh guest. A fresh stream of sensations. Can we stay relaxed and appreciate all this freshness of experience? And lastly, we can begin to taste that nothing we experience stays. There are all these fresh arisings, and there are all these passings. Can we stay in relaxed relationship in the smooth stream? Aware of the freshness of a new breath, but it doesn't stay. There's an out-breath. The freshness of new sounds, yet none of them stay. The fresh sensations in our body of heartbeat, but no pulse stays. So we can be in this streaming process that's smooth because of the samadhi, but it's streaming, full of arising and passing experiences. Let's keep it simple and right there. That's enough of an exploration. Somehow all this arising and passing can happen within a smooth, collected stream. And you can notice if your stream got a little jumbly in hearing the bell. But can we recollect ourselves into the stream of simple presence? Stay relaxed. And now practice this in walking meditation. First, develop some coherence and ease and relaxation, just in taking simple steps backwards and forwards. Find the sweetness and the wholeness in feeling your body walk. Feel the relaxation, how it impacts your sense doors of hearing and seeing, staying inside your body while you walk, really appreciating what your hips and your legs and your feet do while walking. And then within that smooth stream of enjoying simple walking practice, you can also see there are fresh experiences arising in every moment. And maybe looking at something that looks like the same wall, but I'm receiving fresh light, and the light tones are different as the day goes on. So this is freshly arisen light I'm seeing. Freshly arisen sounds I'm hearing, freshly arisen body sensations as I'm walking. So enjoy that exploration. Be very patient, gentle, kind with yourself while you explore that. And we'll come back at 10:30 to sit together. Let's come back into a posture that is kind to our bodies, allows them to be at ease as much as is possible given our current health and the state of our bodies. We can still be kind to them, give them an easeful posture. As parts of this map become more familiar and intuitive, you don't need every piece. You can just align yourself with your breathing and relax. See if you can enjoy, be content with, one breath at a time. You can know your body in its whole posture and allow it to be at ease. You can also go through your body while you're breathing, area by area, feeling what's happening, being aware of that part of your body, inviting it to relax. And if your body relaxes, you can appreciate the energetic aliveness of your body happening in a field of relaxation and contentment. Maybe the way that carbonated water is both still and relaxed inside of a glass. And yet there are little bubbles. You can feel this blending of ease and relaxation that opens up to the flow of aliveness. The aliveness doesn't have to become restless. Contentment doesn't have to become sleepy. You can appreciate a relaxed body that is still energetically alive and dynamic. The happier you are in the present moment, the easier you can let go of old mental habits that draw us into wandering. While remaining relaxed, we can make open-handed invitations for there only to be appreciation of breathing inside a relaxed and well body, not through force or willpower. But there's a sweetness in the mind, content with just breathing. When our minds are in some kind of samadhi, happy to be breathing, to be aware of your body and body sensations. You might actively appreciate. This is a mind without torments of impatience, insecurity, and anger, greed, competitiveness, insecurity. It's subtle, and you can feel the well-being. An embodied attention, humble, satisfied, contented. But just breathing or being aware of your animal body. Its simple anatomy or its simple flow of sensations. To allow for happy contentedness, you might also have to allow for a little bit of sleepiness. A little bit of wandering. And you can invite a little less sleepiness, a little less wandering. But nothing that re-agitates you. This is not a practice of struggle and willpower. A practice of gentleness and patience. And right in the flow of this experience of breathing and feeling your body, wandering of your mind into thoughts or hearing sounds, you can add in the reflection. All these experiences are freshly arising and not staying. This is much more like a stream of water. Everything is flowing, constantly changing. And yet with the samadhi, there's smoother flow. We're flowing on the one hand, ever changing on the other. Appreciation of arising and passing. And be an honest intimacy with the flow of our direct experience. And a key insight is to see we're not making things impermanent. Through steady intimacy, we are seeing the nature of impermanence. Sounds are inherently impermanent. Body sensations are inherently impermanent. thoughts have the nature to be impermanent. Breathing has to be impermanent. This is not a forced interpretation. It's born out of steady intimacy. This is a true nature of all sensed experience. It all has this universal taste of arising and passing. Now again, we have a half hour for walking meditation. And again, blending the ease and simplicity and enjoyment of being embodied, being in the present, being simple. That helps with cultivating wholeness of attention and samadhi. And then within that ease of being present, you can add the reflection that every moment is fresh and fleeting. Fleeting in that it'll never be 11 o'clock on March 20th, 2022 again. Here it is, there it goes. And here it is, there it goes. And that's how a stream works. A stream is not like a brick holding its shape through hundreds of years. A stream is water. It can go through still moments. It can shake, it can flow, but it's ever dynamic. But it doesn't have to be chaotic. There can be smoothness in that flow. And that's what we're using these practices to wake up to. And it's how we cross over from the cultivation of samadhi into the cultivation of streaming into arising and passing experiences. So enjoy that exploration while walking, and we'll come back for a little more theory and conversation about this practice. So we'll add on a little bit to the theory and then open up to any observations you've had this morning in your practice, and any questions that are coming up. So what we added in is this turning point from where we're using mindfulness of breathing. Even the very first steps are to collect and gather attention, then to settle the whole body, find some innate well-being in that settling of the body, using that to further settle the mind, and then coming into a wholeness of attention just with breathing. And that's samadhi, where you have an inner sense of well-being, but there's not a lot of turbulence inside. So the sense of settledness, wholeness, relaxation, ease, well-being, even with very simple experiences. In fact, sometimes the simpler, the better for helping our attention settle. So, and there are many techniques that do that. Like, again, you can look at flowing water, you can look at a candle flame, or you can gaze into a fire and see the crackling fire. You can look at flowers and feel your heart mind settle. And these are some of the classical techniques that were taught to help minds settle. They usually use something that's pleasant or beautiful, but simple. Simple, pleasant. The simpleness helps the mind be simple itself. The pleasant helps the present moment be someplace you want to be. And then you let yourself collect and gather on that simplicity. So again, if the body is not feeling well, or if there's pain or tension in the body, that might not help very much with samadhi. When you're practicing samatha meditations, which lead to samadhi, you're not encouraged to sit with pain. If there's a way you could sit or be still, that would alleviate that pain. because it agitates the mind and it undercuts what you're trying to do with samadhi. That's not true in the Vipassana practices, but in the samadhi practices, it's very helpful that the body is comfortable. Happy comfort of mind and body is the foundation for which collectivity happens. And if there's pain or struggle or agitation in the system, then the mind won't reflect very much wholeness of attention or inner well-being. It'll be so agitated. When you blend Vipassana practices and Samatha practices, you get competing information. And that's why it can be a little confusing, where you're supposed to sit with pain for the insight into how the mind reacts to pain. But you're also allowed to let the body be as comfortable as possible. And so then if you do the Vipassana and Samatha practices at the same time, you're going to get conflicting advice. You can practice Vipassana meditation in a very loud, noisy place and watch your mind be reactive, but it's not so great for samadhi. So when these two are separated, you can see how they operate and then maybe how to rejoin them and let them nourish each other. And that's more of what I did in the second monastery I went to. And I learned so much from being able to separate them and then rejoin them. Whereas in the popular Burmese practice that I went to first, they were joined. And I felt that I was being pushed and pulled in two different directions. So the first 12 steps of the 16 that we're practicing have a lot more encouragement of pleasure, of happiness, of simplicity, healing your body by helping it relax, healing your mind by allowing it to relax. And there's really clear instruction to cultivate that. So I was sort of shocked when I saw these are the 16 steps of mindfulness and breathing, and the first 12 are about creating happiness and well-being in the present. There's this statement that the Buddha's teachings are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And I didn't find them so good in the beginning. They were interesting in the beginning, but I had to confront a lot of pain and a lot of craziness of mind. And I wasn't so sure they were good in the middle, but I could see their promise. So all the good was going to come at the end in enlightenment. But I was curious, like, how come you keep saying it's good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end? It's pretty tough in the beginning. And when samatha practices are brought in, the mind is still grumpy and still has its habits. But I think more clearly, you can feel some of the positive impact of being mindful, cultivating calm and well-being. And it's like, oh, possibly if I was taught this earlier on, I might have found it was good in the beginning and then good in the middle and good in the end. So that's a short little marble that's been rolling around in my brain for a while. I share that with you. So I'm going to share a screen here and show the 14 steps that we're covering so far. We're just missing the last two. I want to make sure you can see all 14. People can see all 14. So again, the first 12 are for settling and collecting and finding an innate sense of happiness and well-being, calming down the habits of the mind and body, and then dropping into some type of samadhi. And then knowing in step 12, this is a mind without torments. My mind is not strained or tormented. From there, we go into the fourth grouping, step 13. And some of the English words here are a little clunky, but the word here is contemplating anicca, contemplating impermanence. The core of that word is nicca, which is eternal, So anicca is the non-eternal nature, and you're to contemplate it not as a thought process, but you taste it in the stream of experience. You can taste quick impermanence, like a sound coming and going. You can also walk through your neighborhood and see houses getting older. And you could walk through a forest and see some trees in states of aging and falling over. So you can look at large arc impermanence or very quick impermanence. But this is to use the samadhi, the intimacy that comes with the samadhi of being present in your heart, mind, and body. And you might just enjoy that. You might just stop at step 12. And when the Buddha practiced, he got taught samadhi practices. And you could say they kind of stopped at step 12 because there was so much benevolence just in samadhi. And the Buddha's insight was there was further insights needed. And so this begins vipassana practice. Vipassana practice begins with seeing impermanence. And then there are many insights that grow out of seeing impermanence. But the first thing is to accurately perceive how much change is going on all the time. We probably know that up in our heads, but you want to actually taste it through your perception that everything has the mark of impermanence. Everything you see, taste, smell, touch, whatever you think about, has this universal characteristic of being impermanent. So that's what we do in step 13. It's the beginning of vipassana practice, opening up to impermanence, and then all the ramifications of impermanence are also vipassana practice. Here I'm separating samatha and vipassana, but I think it makes more sense if you look at it this way. And then as you contemplate impermanence, there's a type of inflammation and agitation that begins to drain out of your mind. If you do it in the right way, if you do it too quickly, your mind gets more worried and more anxious about the impermanence. But if you have samadhi inside you, then in that inner samadhi, you feel well enough that when you start opening up to the arising and passing nature of experience, the underlying well-being from the samadhi allows you to explore and increase the sensitivity appearance. And so a description of what this looks like is if you were to open 1 liter, 2 liters of water and then hold it over a cup perfectly vertical, it would splash out. As air would try to go in and water would come out, it'd be chaotic. It would splash in the cup, it'd splash outside the cup. And so that's turbulent flow. The water is definitely flowing, but it's full of turbulence. And so it's very different if you slowly tilt the container over, so you start to get a stream of water coming out. And it's definitely changing because it's a stream. But there's a coherence in the stream. And in that coherence, it's not as agitating. And so, what we're doing with samadhi and impermanence is the samadhi gives us the coherence, but it doesn't become permanent because it can't become permanent. And so, right here in steps in the third and fourth tetrad, we go into what feels like calm, stable flow, and then we appreciate the flowing nature of things arising and passing. And because of the internal coherence, you're not facing all the possibilities of impermanence at one go. But if you're still agitated and then you contemplate impermanence, you're feeling not that well. Kind of agitated, your mind is already fragmented, And then you open up to however changing the world is, and you want to grab your desk and hold on. It's like, I can't handle it being more impermanent because I'm already kind of shaken and fragmented. So here we want to actually get into some samadhi, but it's not a spaced out dissociated samadhi. We're not having a visualization, merging into that visualization and leaving all the world behind. We've actually found samadhi in the breath and in the body. And so you're already in an intimate, stable flow with the breath and body. You don't have to look somewhere else to find impermanence. You find the breath is impermanent, body sensations are impermanent, and then you can rock back and forth between these two and then see, actually, they don't have to be in contradiction. The samadhi that's giving a general sense of coherence in the flow makes the sense of arising and passing actually kind of beautiful. So there are other parts of arising and passing and impermanence that are more threatening. But here you can start to open up to impermanence and see it's actually, it has kind of a beautiful edge. If you're used to there being birds, a bird can come and go and call at your window, and you don't take it, you take it for granted, so you don't tune in very much. But if you're present and then you hear the bird call, you might hear all the little different chirps. And it's the fact that it arises and passes and is unique that it starts to draw your attention in. Same with your body. This is a fresh breath and it doesn't stay. Let me tune in and appreciate it. So this is a gentle crossing over from just developing samadhi to where you can start noticing arising and passing. And then you get to step 14, and the word viraga is translated as dispassion. That may be too solemn. You could think about viraga as the healing of inflammation. So my sister is a nurse, and one thing she looks at when there's a cut or an infection is how red is it around the cut, the splinter or the infection. And the redder it is, the worse the infection is. As it begins to heal, maybe before the cut heals, the area around it stops being so red and inflamed. And you might know what it's like when your body is getting over an illness and there's inflammation and soreness, but that inflammation and soreness begins to pass. That might be more what this word viraga points to, is the lowering of inflammation, the lowering of aching, the lowering of agitation from not being well. And you're heading towards wellness. So as viraga comes in, they say it's also like a choppy water blown by the wind, and then the wind dies down and there's still waves, but slowly the surface goes back to smooth because it's not being as agitated. So strangely, tuning into impermanence you think might agitate our systems, but actually tuning into impermanence, especially with samadhi backing us up, you might start to feel, oh, there's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to create drama over. This is all just ever-changing experience. I'm already well. I'm relaxed. Everything's changing. There's not a lot of room for drama here. There's nothing I can possess here. There's nothing worth hating. It's just transitory sound. Well, this impermanence backed up by samadhi, I feel this inflammation and agitation of my worldly mind starting to come down, both from the well-being of samadhi, but now this has got the gift of wisdom in it too. Everything is changing, and the most peaceful relationship is consciousness, appreciation, vividness. But yeah, everything's already changing. That's their nature. And you might notice that your whole heart, mind, and body takes a big breath and relaxes and goes, oh my God, I was trying to make the perfect sandcastle. And I was always afraid of the incoming waves and tide. But it was always a sandcastle. So Oh, letting go is a lot easier if I have a friendly relationship to impermanence. Here you can build and extend impermanence, get some healing from it, open up to feeling greater impermanence, get some healing from it. If you ever get overwhelmed by opening up to impermanence, then you can dial it back and just feel the samadhi of breathing in and out, regroup, settle in, and then reopen up to impermanence until you find the threatening edge of impermanence. And there you can breathe and say, oh, right on this edge, I can see how I'm fighting to keep something permanent, but it's completely made of impermanent factors. I think I'd better relax in there. You relax there, less inflammation, more healing, and then you can go out further. So here you're using the first 12 steps of developing samadhi, intimacy, especially with the breath and body, then turning to an honest relationship with the impermanent nature of the body sensations of your breathing. And that becomes a pleasant entry point and a safe entry point that you can build upon to open up to impermanence so that you get this healing of inflammation. And the healing of inflammation is all the consternation we feel of trying to build security of impermanent things. And so we're very fatigued by it, very fragmented by it, very obsessed and very uncertain of ourselves because our strategy is backwards. So to actually ripen step 14 of having agitation leave your system, you want to start where impermanence has a pleasant edge, relax a little bit, and then open up. And then eventually you get to your own impermanence, or the impermanence of your loved ones, and the impermanence of your property, the impermanence of the planet. But you don't go right to that. Otherwise, your mind's going to clench, and then it's all frustration and agitation. And it's hard to actually ripen a glad relationship, a wise relationship to impermanence. And it can feel like a bitter pill to swallow. But if you can cross over from samadhi with breath and body into fresh arisings, fresh passings, arising and passing, then the inflammation can be drained out of your system, which means you can handle opening up to larger topics. So with that said, I'm curious if you have any observations of your own practice this morning, any questions? We'll have one more sit together, then one more walking, and then a final discussion together. So in this sit, I'll incorporate the last two steps of the 16, which is opening up to endings and the completeness of endings. So things arise and pass. In the passing, we recognize in passing things don't go into storage where we can pull them up again. In the arising and the passing, when things pass, they go into complete endings. And there again, we can warm up to this and find the soothing and relieving relationship to endings. I'll guide us in that, and we can explore that experientially. So once again, find a posture that's kind to your body. This is helpful for happiness here and now. It's also a good thing to do to a human animal, is to allow it to be still and restful and at ease. Take a few deep breaths. Allow as full a letting go as possible, a full relaxation, emptying out. As we relax and fully empty out, what we're left in is a simple stream of present time experiences. Relax and empty out. Our bodies have a chance to relax, empty out of their holding patterns. It allows our bodies to relax and open up a little bit. Same with our minds, relax and empty out. And what we're left with is a more simple stream. Mental content as thoughts and spaciousness in the thoughts and around the thoughts. In the stream will be passing emotions, like states of weather, different cognitive states, sleepiness and driftiness, more energetic states. We can just relax into the stream. We don't have to make anything particular happen. We can trust our bodies to breathe, have a heartbeat, and digest our food. We can relax and let them do that. See again if we can guide ourselves to be content with simply breathing in, simply breathing out, and no bigger agenda than peacefully and simply appreciating this is an in-breath and this is an out-breath. And you can go through the various steps that help open samadhi. And sometimes you can just drop into contentedness with breathing, a simple, humble, open attention to breathing. Maybe your mind drops into a kind of samadhi. Happy, content, not distracted, not restless, just breathing, relaxed wholeness of attention. We can welcome two orientations to the stream of our experience. One is a more calm system. So the stream flows more smoothly. Smoothness of breathing, smoothness of body sensations. Less agitation. And also being a stream, it is made up of arising and passing events. The arising of sounds, body sensations, breath, the arising of thoughts, emotions, and cognitive states. And the passing of all that arises. Sounds don't stay, they can't stay. The breath doesn't stay, it can't stay. All the sensations in your body are fluid and changing. They're not of the nature to stay. Even mindfulness and samadhi can't stay. They're not meant to be permanent. They arise when the conditions are supportive. They pass. They arise again. We can have the view of streaming and have some smoothness. A lack of crude turbulence. And this is both samadhi and the experience of anicca streaming together. And then the last two steps of the 16 are to open up to the fullness and completion of endings. In the arising and passing, the passing is so thorough that nothing gets to linger. So all the days, including yesterday, that have happened before have passed. We're not burdened by them. We have memories of them, but no access to previous days other than memory. Past years have passed. Past months have passed. Past weeks and past days have passed. All past hours have passed. If you approach this gently, you can feel the lightness that comes. There's no way to hold on to something that has passed. And if you can breathe there and relax there, it simplifies. It's like going to bed at night. You couldn't let the day pass, you couldn't sleep. But you get all the relief of sleeping because the mind can let go. Let the day come to an end. Here we are contemplating Nirodha, cessation, complete endings, and seeing if there can be a lightness, a relief, a quieting. Already a sense of peace. If you want to step closer to this, you can imagine you're standing at the top of a waterfall. The waterfall doesn't have a bottom. The river just pours over, falls, disappears in the past. when you tune into the peacefulness of this, you can give it everything. It won't stop the next arising. In fact, it makes room for the next arising. We couldn't take an in-breath if we hadn't fully let go of the last breath. How much more full is today when we let go of yesterday? When we approach it carefully and mindfully, we can let these endings be medicine for our ease, for our lightness, for our simplicity. You can tune into the space after a bird call, after a train of thought, after a breath. Feel the peacefulness. When approached in this way, you allow your breathing to support you, while one moment after another disappears and ends. The softness of your breathing consoles you. Let there be endings. They're already happening. They're very natural. As we warm up to and find peace with the truth of endings, can you even contemplate clinging? Does clinging have any ground to stand on? Everything comes to an end. Endings are natural. Endings are full and complete. A mind at peace with endings can hardly contemplate how and why you could cling. We cling because we're afraid of endings. So breathing, feeling well-being, witnessing one moment after another going quiet, like a wave, or incoming tide cleaning the beach, all the footsteps and sandcastles. Peaceful beach afterwards. Be consoled by your breath. Endings have been happening since there were beginnings. This is natural. And here is another ending. So with the complete ending of the sitting period, there is a full canvas of consciousness to engage with the walking. And if the sitting didn't come to an end, you'd have to haul it on your back and there would be less room for walking. And then the walking will come to an end and we'll meet back again in a half hour. So we have time for another presentation on the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, and then time for conversation about it. Any questions that are arising, any observations that you've made through this weekend's practice or in previous practice. And then if you have any questions about your practice in general, that would also be a time to ask those questions. But I've put the the text over in the chat. It's not formatted like the PDF that I've been sharing, but I think I can give it to the folks at VIMS and they can send it out to you so you can have a copy of that PDF of the 16 steps. I've actually done some of my own translations. Not so much of my own translations as I've combed through many variations of the 16 steps, and I've liked a nuance that a teacher pulled out in that translation, other people, and kind of worked with it myself. You'll find the Pali words and Pali phrases are consistent and they're 2,500 years old, but searching for the nuanced English to help those 16 steps be more accessible if you're not a native Pali speaker. And yeah, we're still searching for what the right words to use are and how that maps onto our own practice and our own intuition. So here we have the 16 steps. Is that clear enough to people? Yeah, okay. So the last two steps that we added in the last sitting meditation was contemplating Nirodha. And Nirodha is the full and complete ending without any remainder. It's a complete zeroing out. And the Buddha used that when he talked about the complete ending of suffering was suffering Nirodha. And when the Buddha talked about defeating dependent origination, he used this word Nirodha. And so getting to know what this word Nirodha, Anicca, Viraga, Nirodha, those are three Pali words that are more in the Vipassana insight side of our meditative tradition, including direct seeing and contemplations. But there are other words that are over in the more Vipassana side of the equation. And that's captured here in the fourth tetrad. So you don't have to practice all these steps like walking up a 16-rung ladder. They can ripen at different times, but there is a little wisdom to how you might progress through this in a linear way. So again, by breathing in, by getting oriented to your breath, that will soothe your mind some, that will relax your body some, then you can go into your body, know it in full, And then invite any part of your body that can relax to relax. Anytime you ripen one step, the next step is more accessible, practically, but also theoretically. But yeah, practically, if you get to know your breath, you have a chance to know your body. If you get to know your body, you have a chance to relax your body. That opens up the experience of aliveness in your body from being a compressed, tired, lump of cement or numb to your body. As it relaxes holistically, there's more circulation, there's more flow, you can feel the aliveness in your body. And in your body, you start to experience your body and your knowing of your body as a place of contentment. That further helps you relax your mental habits, mental sankharas, and you can calm them more thoroughly. As they go into great quietude, the machinations of your mind, you can see the realm of your mind more clearly. It's not as turbulent. You can gladden your mind, make sure that it's warm and buoyant. That mind stream you take into samadhi of your breath and your body. And then you, if you're in that stream, it might not occur to you, but in that stream, you can see what a mind stream is like when it's not tormented. And that shows you what the Buddha's path leads towards. It leads towards a mind that's not tormented. In samadhi, the torments have just gone dormant, but it does give you a sense of which way the path heads. It doesn't head towards greater wealth. It doesn't head towards whiter teeth. It doesn't head towards greater popularity. It doesn't head towards a cooler looking jacket. It heads towards this sense of, wow, I'm not afflicted. I'm not tormented inside. But to really uproot the ground that torments grow in, we need Vipassana practice. So when we look around and see things and interpret things as being permanent, we overinvest in the relationship of things that we think we're permanent, we think that thing is permanent, and then we unconsciously invest in a solid relationship. And then we grieve when we change and whatever we're relating to changes. We go back into insecurity. So Vipassana truths tend to be challenging to our conventional perspective around safety and security and happiness. They're harder truths to mature in relationship to. And yet they end up being more liberating. And we end up being more grateful to live in accord with them. But they're harder to get the ordinary mind to warm up their relationship to what's in the Vipassana truths. That's why if you have some deepened samadhi and you can be intimate with your breath and be content with something as simple as your breath, it's not as hard to go into Vipassana training. And at the time of the Buddha, most of the meditative traditions were based in samadhi. And so he was able to make a bridge over very easily into his forms of meditation, as long as there wasn't too much of an ideological hardening around, I've now come in contact with my eternal soul and the eternal mind of all consciousness. I am free. I don't even want to hear what you have to say. That'd be a hard person to teach, but if you had the experience of softening, being in the actual samadhi, you could be shown his teachings very easily. And he incorporated a lot of the practices of samadhi into his teachings because they were so helpful. So we turn towards arising and passing. It's all through the mindfulness discourses to watch something arise, watch it pass, watch it arise and pass. Seeing this internally, and externally. And that opens up a sensitivity to the great sea of conditionality that's broiling all the time. And we have no control over the great sea of conditionality. We can barely influence ourselves and the environment around us, but there are conditions much greater than we'll ever control. And that attuning to anicca opens that door, and then you get to see how things actually are by having samadhi. And mindfulness of impermanence opens up a greater seeing of how things actually are. And then from that, we go into this dispassion, which again, from our egoic perspective, sounds boring and it sounds flat. And it's not at all what you want for your vacation is dispassion. You kind of want passion on your vacation. You want great sights and great foods and stimulation. Someone said, oh, you know, go on this vacation and become dispassionate. Like, how many people would go for that brochure until you're tired of all the agitations of life? And it's just not about becoming unpassionate in terms of uncaring. It's about inflammation. It's about exhaustion. It's about restlessness. It's about constantly seeking refuge where you can't find any. Then feeling this background agitation, inflammation begin to calm down. And you still might have immature attitudes that still would like to rev things up into agitation as long as it's fun. And so this takes some maturing that it's great to go to block parties and farmers markets, and it's great to have to see festivals, and but you want to be careful that you're not taking in a lot of agitation and then leaving exhausted because of it. But you don't have to like only be happy in a cave in order to ripen viraga. So that takes time for that to mature organically. And you can be preemptive on it with some reflection and conversation, but actually have it come down and teach your heart that it doesn't want agitation. And there's a way to have a very vivid life that's not, that doesn't have to come with agitation. And that's what contemplating impermanence does. So those two, each one of these tetrads is built with pairs, and the structure of it is pretty amazing, that you have 16 steps, they break into four groups of four, and each four has a pairing. And if you get to know them and work with them in pairs, there's some structure there. So that's interesting. After your system calms down some and you feel some befriending of impermanence, you don't have to get all the way befriending impermanence, because impermanence means that we won't live forever. And it means that anything we build and construct will fall apart. That takes some getting used to it, but it does bring down a lot of agitation from things falling apart when you didn't think they would. So you let steps 13 and 14 ripen, and they ripen if the third tetrad of some type of samadhi has ripened. That's more likely to ripen if you've calmed your mind down and calmed your body down. And that opens up the possibility of contemplating Nirodha, this deep truth that all things end. And then you don't even get to keep a memento after the fact. We have memory, and through memory, we can make the past seem very vivid. But in truth, we cannot actually access the past. We have memories that are vivid, so it feels accessible. We feel haunted by the past because we remember it. There is momentum from the past that we experience today. So there are echoes and momentum of the past. And to understand that momentum, we do have to reflect upon the past. But the actual past is gone. The actual past is inaccessible. And so tuning into Nirodha, where it's not threatening, when it's not this great annihilation, but where you find the peacefulness of it, where you feel the exhale It's more likely to come if you've come to terms with anicca and started to feel the draining of inflammation from your system. That gives you an intuitive clue that maybe endings aren't to be feared. They're natural. And then you find the easy access endings and start appreciating that you couldn't sleep at night if you couldn't let go of the day. And some people get insomnia because their minds won't let go of the day. And then how fatigued you are waking up to the next day when you feel so burdened by the past day. So this letting go process, because things actually end, they ripen together. And so we have steps 15 and 16 that ripen. The very first teachings on Anapanasati were mindfully I breathe in, mindfully I breathe out, and I practice letting go. That's the same Pali word as what we have here in contemplating full release, is that in Nirodha, when you actually find Nirodha peaceful, just like in Samadhi, there are no torments, but it might not stand out to you. You're enjoying Samadhi, but you can, in the stream of Samadhi, say, wow, my mind is not tormented. When you become peaceful with Nirodha, with this great cessation, you have a deeper set of conditions where suffering cannot even arise. So if Samadhi were to be like a lawnmower going over all these plants and clear them, the roots of them are still there and they can grow new plants. But with contemplating Nirodha and a mind that's peaceful with Nirodha, a mind that's peaceful with this great cessation, the great endings without remainder, as you work out your struggle with Nirodha and get more peaceful with it and don't find it depressing, but find it actually peace-inducing, and the more there is emptiness of Nirodha, the more room there is for new things to grow. Like if the plants of last year didn't die in your garden, there wouldn't be room for new plants. And so the endings actually play a role in why life is vivid and why it's beautiful, but you have to become comfortable with endings. The mind that is oriented to and peaceful and fully open to endings does not have a single ingredient in it that can build a torment. Whereas Samadhi can decay, you can be in sweet Samadhi, just your breath, and then somebody starts chainsawing a tree next to you, or your housemates start to argue and you hear that. Samadhi can be fragile, but if you're actually in the wisdom relationship to endings, it's almost like you've taken the whole dirt away from the roots, and there's no way for them to actually grow new trees, no new plant life. So Samadhi makes things dormant and lay unconscious underground, whereas Nietzsche, Viraga, and Nirodha, this tetrad, and why it's so liberating, it's like taking dry kindling, putting it near a fire, and any spark could start the dry kindling. And then you take that same kindling and you soak it in water for a week, and you can put it right next to the fire and no spark can start the wet kindling, because the conditions are so antagonistic to fire. And a mind that's grown in relationship to this fourth tetrad loses its ingredients for suffering, loses its capacity for suffering. Unpleasant experiences happen. There's enough samadhi in your being, enough understanding of impermanence, that you can do something about the suffering or not. But in terms of if you have pain in your body or a sound that's too loud, we can suffer over that because we don't have a relationship to impermanence. We haven't drained inflammation out of our system So we come to agitation around unpleasant experiences. And because we're not comfortable with Nirodha very deeply and intuitively, we still have the ingredients for attachment, for identification, for thinking that if we just did it this way or that way, we could avoid suffering. So getting experientially aligned with Nirodha takes out suffering, and then step 16 almost completes itself by understanding Nirodha, is that you have a mind that can't actually generate suffering, and the conditions for suffering are even more removed than just being in samadhi, because you have the wisdom perspective not to get caught up in attachment, not to get caught up in taking hard stances, not to get caught up in trying to cling to anything. It's like being a child and making a sandcastle, getting attached to it and then fearing the incoming tide, versus being an adult that still might want to make a very beautiful sandcastle, but never did it occur to you, no matter how beautiful you made, that it was going to last, because the conditions are not one of permanence. So it all is to be washed away back into the sea, but it doesn't stop you from making sandcastles. And maybe you don't even have to make sandcastles. You can, and you don't have to. That's the freedom of Vipassana insights, is that it takes away the ingredients that we need to mix in order to suffer and restart our agitating process. And the last thing I'll say in this way, and then we can talk more about it, the theory of it and such, is that last couple of things is that you go through this and then you recommit back to the beginning and you develop an even stronger relationship to the breath, an even more permeated experience of your body, which allows an even deeper relaxation of your body. The experience of aliveness becomes more liberated, so your body has a lot of energy flow in it. As you work with that, the sense of happiness and contentment is even more stable. That exposes mental habits you have that are running in the background. If you're only so happy, you can't really tell that you have an unhappy mind. But once you start to taste a deep sense of contentment, the way your mind is processing things unconsciously begin to stand out more, and you can become more conscious of your mental habits. Herein, there are other practices that help quiet mental habits. And this is where you have many meditative techniques depending on what your mind is agitated by. So if you have a mind that goes into hatred easily, you practice loving kindness. If you have a mind that enjoys thoughts of cruelty, is the sound still good? Can you still hear me? Yeah, good.
Yes, you're good.
Great. So in order to really calm your mental habits in step 8, you might need to add something to just breath awareness, like loving kindness practices. If you have a lot of envy or a lot of competitiveness where somebody else being happy makes you feel insecure, you practice mudita practice. And as a medicine, it calms down that whole area where you can actually celebrate other people's happiness. So your mind relaxes more. And so to really get your mind to keep deepening, you can just do more body awareness, more breath awareness. But you can also do specific meditations that help a certain mental habit that doesn't relax easily. There are people who suffer a lot from anxiety and doubt. And the meditative tool there is to practice faith practice and trust practice. And you can make your sense of faith and trust so strong that it's very hard for anxiety and doubt to get inside and start telling you a story that feeds more anxiety and doubt. So there are other meditative techniques, and they tend to be a deepening here, getting to know the body better, doing a sense of breaking it down into its anatomical parts, or knowing the sensations of the body and getting to the four elements practice. That helps with the first tetrad, knowing your mind, calming your mind. There's a lot of meditative reflections that help with that. Developing samadhi, stabilizing samadhi. There are different meditative techniques that help with that. And so here we have sort of a straight line of practice, but it can be augmented and supported by other meditative practices, depending on what you find in your own heart and mind as deeper habits. And then the fourth tetrad, the Vipassana tetrad, there are places that we have a hard time experiencing anicca, impermanence. And so there are meditative practices to help with that. We have a hard time with death and dying. And so rather than being surprised and hijacked by death and dying, you can preemptively meditate upon it, either in the abstract or do direct contact with death and dying, and coax your mind out of its anxiety. And then you have a more broad sense of impermanence. You relax there and even see that there too, death and dying can bring a lot of preciousness to our current life. And without death and dying, we take many days for granted. So then anicca isn't this thing that haunts you. You can actually extend it. And there are meditative practices in how to extend the contemplation of impermanence, how to extend the experience of non-agitation through wisdom, where to look for cessation and impermanence, cessation and endings. You know, we can open up to it kind of diffusely, but we can target it also where they're likely to have a stronger unconscious fear around endings. And then to have many teachings that encourage and describe the experience of letting go, and letting go in a way that is not about throwing things away, throwing yourself away, but how do you live consciously with a heart that doesn't cling, with a heart that enjoys the fluid process. So just wanted to show that there are ways that this integrates with other practices, and then it's not as complicated as, oh my God, one more list and there's 16 things on this list. I was just getting used to the 7 things on the previous list. Now there's twice as much I have to remember. It's also fragmenting. There's a holistic view where all these teachings are pointing in the same direction, and they're just skillful means to help different hooks in the mind, different knots in the mind untangle. But this is one of the clearest sort of straight drop through of how you could start with just simple breathing, work your way progressively down to where there's a deep freedom and letting go. And then you don't have to go to another map. You can actually just keep deepening your relationship to these 16 steps. And this is considered one map to full liberation, where you wouldn't have to graduate from this map to some other map to fully liberate. That just working with mindfulness of breathing, this is how to become fully awakened in 16 steps, starting from just knowing if you're breathing in and out, all the way to deeper and deeper full releases and a deeper sense of happiness along the way. So that's as much as I'll say in this one format. I'd be happy to open up to any questions you have, any observations you had from your own practice. We can be in a little bit more of a conversation around this, or in other parts, how this might integrate with other parts of the Buddha's teachings. And can we cultivate mindfulness of breathing as a refuge? Refuge from the chaotic mind, from worries we can't solve, from agitating habits. Can each breath be a refuge of simple presence and embodiment? I invite you to put your hand over your heart. Feel yourself breathing. Let your own hand on your heart be a symbol of kindness to yourself. May I love myself just as I am. May I be kind to myself just as I am. May I be friendly to myself just as I am. And then with this connection to your own breath and body and your own kindness of heart, you can open the size of your intent, of your attention, and open up to a general sense of the world around you, your immediate sense of your family, your neighbors, the region of the world you're in. Let your heart go out to where you know that there is suffering. In every being on this planet would benefit from all four Brahma Viharas. So breathing in and out, we can offer the warmth of friendship, loving kindness, of metta. We can offer a heart of compassion for every being, for the hardship and grief and loss and pain that all beings experience. And we can open our hearts up through the channel of mudita, the joy we feel in the well-being of others. There is laughter even on hospice wards. There are children playing and laughing in Ukraine. Even where you don't expect there to be joy, joy will pass through. Very beautiful part about consciousness. No pain has ever been so great that it has completely blocked out joy. And sometimes joy gets richer when it's awakened next to compassion. This way we use the breath and our bodies to be resourced enough that we can sustain a heart connection to all life. And then finally, there's the Brahma Vihara of equanimity. The willingness to be present. And the constant flow of gain and loss, pleasure and pain, times of ease, times of challenge. That's how this universe works. We can keep our heart open and our eyes open to witness the actual planet we're on. Find some balance with our eyes open. I invite you to open your eyes and to look at the various people you've been sitting with this weekend. Many people are very dedicated Dharma practitioners. And some people are just lighting their first fires of Dharma and meditation. But all of it is a courageous act to be tender and more feeling, more ethically aware. And so when you look at a Dharma circle, you're looking at people who are trying their best to not be selfish, to be generous, to feel the actual worlds they're in, be kinder to themselves and kinder to the beings around them. So we can reach out and send each other one more wagging of the tail. May each of you be happy and peaceful in your lives. May each of you be healthy and strong. May each of you be safe from danger. And may each of you find a way to live at ease in this world. Thank you, everybody, for coming this weekend. Hope to see you all in the stream, downstream later on. It's been really nice to spend the weekend with you.